Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Krim Bailey Ray's an English singer-songwriter whose career started with a bang. In 2006, her debut album topped UK charts and was certified triple platinum with the help of her first hit single, Put Your Records On. A slew of awards and other Best New Artist distinctions followed. As she put out subsequent albums, Krim aspired to stretch herself as an artist beyond neo-soul pop music success. In September, Krim Bailey Ray released her fourth album, Black Rainbows. It's an album inspired by her time spent exploring Chicago's historic Stony Island Arts Bank, a vast collection of black cultural relics and writing. Corinne's new album is in many ways a reaction to the art she consumed in that archive. It's performed in a mix of jazz, rock, and the avant-garde. On today's episode, I talked to Krim Bailey Ray about the years she spent in the Arts Bank archives and the stories that inspired her new work. She also talked about her record label's exhaustive efforts to push her to recreate the success of her first album and how a skateboarding magazine helped clarify the look of her new record. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's my conversation with Krim Bailey Ray.
Your record, I listened to it, I guess, went for a walk to go get some coffee and listened to it again. Like, it is really surprising how many different sounds are on here. Like, I loved that I never settled into like a groove listening to it. It's like with each song, it's like it's kind of growing, evolving, changing. It's awesome. It's incredible.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I wanted to have all these different styles, but it really came about naturally from responding to the objects, responding to the events. The idea that came seemed to be in a particular style, whether it was, you know, a punk song or whether it's more aggressive guitars or whether it's more like a ballad or something more psychedelic. Like it all just kind of presenting itself to me like that. But yeah, it is. It bounces you around a lot.
What were the first handful of songs that you came up with for the record? Because I'm just curious how, you know, like how it started and how it evolved sonically.
I think the first handful of songs were, I wrote some in the residency. I went to the Arts Bank. Once I'd encountered the Arts Bank building, you know, Stony Island Arts Bank in Chicago, you can see pictures of it online. It's the foundation that runs it is called the Rebuild Foundation. It's on the south side of Chicago, which I don't know how much you know about the south side, but it was a very vibrant middle-class black area in the 60s. And then it's just had so much decline and unfunding. And now it's really, there's a lot of difficult issues there with housing, mental health, drugs, violence. But there's this one building there on Stony Island that hasn't been pulled down by the city. The city wanted to pull it down, and Theaster Gates saved it. He bought it for a dollar and raised wow. $4 million by selling his own art to make this a building again. So instead of being full of money, it's full of art. It's full of art artifacts. It's full of 26,000 books that were submitted to the Johnson Foundation, who did Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine.
Wow,
so all
cool,
the books,
amazing.
Exactly. So all the books that were submitted to them over the years for review, as well as the books that John Johnson and the Johnsons collected. And then it has all of Frankie Knuckles' records. So it's got this big slice of, you know, Chicago house music. And it has all the glass slides from the University of Chicago. So when they digitized their archive, they just gave all this a bang. They had nowhere to store it all. And it also has all these difficult objects that were pulled out of circulation by a black and Chinese banker called Ed Williams. Problematic objects from America's past, you know, the trinkets and the mammy jars and newspaper articles, photographs, cartoons, all of these things that he would find in flea markets and yard sales that he wanted to just buy and put in a box in his house so nobody else was buying them and putting them in their house and keeping it all going. So he had these boxes and boxes of things, and they became too much even for him to be around. 16,000 objects. So they are also all in the bank as well. So I went looking around just as a tourist, as someone who's interested in history and black histories and stories and hidden stories, erased stories. And when I left, I just couldn't help but, you know, I was just scribbling a poem here or starting to write a song here. And I spoke to Theaster about it, and he said, you know, you should come back, be an artist in residence. You know, they have buildings nearby. So we stayed there for 2 weeks and just really dug into the archive, read loads of books, saw loads of objects, attended loads of events. And then I've just been going back there very regularly all through these years, you know, since 2017. So, I mean, the first song I ever wrote about the bank was called You Who Walk These Floors in Fear, because I had seen a sculpture that was made from the abandoned floorboards from a police station. The police station had been left for many decades, and these floorboards were from there. And I thought about what they had been witness to, you know, how often in history it's this, the witnesses are silent, you know, they're the buildings, they're the windows, they're the trees, the soil, the slave cabin, that, you know, the things that can't talk, but they, you know, they've seen a truth.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing I wrote. That's kind of on, I guess, a part two of the record, which I haven't finished. But then I wrote He Will Follow With His Eyes and Erasure, and then maybe Before the Throne of the Invisible God. It just kind of, you know, started from there.
He Will Follow You With His Eyes is certainly like a dance element to it. So maybe that's the Frankie Knuckles Chicago house of it all. How did you write that song? Like, did it start off with words? Were you at a piano, guitar?
With He Will Follow You With His Eyes, I had seen all this advertising. I'd found a tin of a beauty product when I was in Chicago. I'd opened the drawers of the stone in the Ed Williams collection and seen this tin, and it had this beautiful illustration on, and it was this company called Valmore. So then when I was home, I was doing all this research about Valmore and finding out they were kind of like the Avon of their day. So they would sell these beauty products door to door. The guy who did the art for them, they all had these amazing illustrations on line drawings, and it was this black artist called Charles Dawson. So they had very sympathetic drawings, you know, that the line was targeted at black men and women. And it was targeted in this really romantic way. Whoever did the marketing was really good. So the perfumes would be called things like Follow Me Boy or Look Me Over. And then when you'd read something in, you know, Ebony or another publication about Valmore, and it would have all the products listed, it would say in a big banner across the top, you know, his eyes will follow you across the room, you know, and it'd be a series of wigs or something that they were selling. So they sold all kinds of things. And I thought about Valmore and just how enticing it was. You know, sometimes I'd read about the hair products and think, I wonder if you could still get this, because it sounded like from the description that it did everything, you know, it's like, it nourishes, but it's not greasy. And, you know, it does that. It's a styling product, and it's a pomade. And I thought, gosh, they were so good. Their marketing was really good. And obviously it was a sympathetic view of black men and women, but it was very much aligned with white beauty. So the beauty they were aiming at was, you know, lighter skin, straighter hair, all of these things. So I guess with the song, I wanted to present a kind of 1950s dream world where you're really under the spell of this kind of advertising. You know, you can imagine them knocking at the door, and if you're a black woman, you know, you're going to be taking the hair straightening cream, and you're going to be taking the skin lightening cream and all of those things. But halfway through the song, the person who has been very much under the spell of Valmore, you know, there's this sonic disruption, and then they end up saying, you know, I don't want to vanish into a girl that I don't recognise. You know, if you want to run to sweet Georgia Brown with another kind of skin lightening cream, you know, light brown is the thing, not dark.
Soon after that line, it's like a break in the song.
Yeah, it's a total
in a really
break.
Cool
and
way.
The person, everything just falls away and it gets much more contemporary. And it's just, you know, I'll be there with my plum red lipstick, my black hair kinky, my black skin gleaming. I wanted it to be a sort of a shock and kind of, you know, really assertive, and that the person would be sort of back in their self and away from this really enticing beauty which held many people under its sway for a really long time.
The repetition of those lines make it really feel like a call to arm as much as like a refrain, you know.
Oh,
it's just,
thank
it's
you.
Beautiful. And like the way it just repeats and repeats and repeats, and the production evolves over that second half of the song, just it's like it feels subversive in a very cool way.
Oh,
you know,
thank you.
As you're writing out the words, you know, at that point the song should move into something else.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a shift away from, you know, in the beginning we had vibraphones and guitars and we had strings and it was all very dreamy. I was imagining, like, you know, those probably Californian movies that were shot, you know, where a car would be sort of winding round the roads, wrapping a mountainside and the sun shining, you know, that kind of 50s dream world. And you can live in it, but at some point you have to, when you break out of it, you realise how all-consuming it was. And so, yeah, I really wanted to have that repetition. But I wrote it on guitar, so I would always just be, like, pulling one string. Plum, red, lipstick, my black hair. And then I guess when we did it in the studio, we just, you know, we wanted it to evolve. Like, don't bring the bass straight away and have this more, like, cosmic sort of weird jazz moments. It's like, is it futuristic? Is it 70s? It's, you know, what we wanted it to be. We want it to be different to what had gone before.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's really cool. And the tone of the beginning does sort of remind me of, like, well, like the late 50s, like early 60s, almost like it's akin to like a Frankie Valli production or something. But then yet again, just like everything else on the record, it's like halfway through, it's like, oh shit, we're onto something else now, you know?
I really liked it. And I thought, you know, some people are saying it's close to what your sound has been historically. So I really liked that idea that you might put it on and be like, oh, finally, I can just kind of relax in this, you know? But then you listen to words. What is she saying? She's saying lighter and brighter. Why is she saying longer and straighter? And, you know, it's kind of, you know, I feel like the I in that song is not really me. It's kind of this, I don't know, Shirley Bassey type Eartha Kitt, you know, deliver everything, you yeah. know, everything, you know. I was being more dramatic than I would normally sing it, you know, trying to sort of be in that world.
I'm so happy to hear a Shirley Bassey reference. I mean, like, she's incredible, and
no one
talks about her anymore. She's and same with Eartha Kitt, like, just uniquely bizarre but beautiful voice.
I love that.
But you know what? I didn't want to say that. But that was my response listening to the albums when it got to that song. I was like, oh, okay, something that, not, you know, it's not that, like, I pigeonhole you in my mind, but by the time I got that song, I was like, oh, this feels like familiar terrain, familiar territory.
Yeah, and it was, and that's, you know, writing it in this sort of bossa nova guitar style. It's like, you know, I write a lot of songs from there, so, yeah.
I love that there's, like, it's not like you rap on it, but there's some tracks, like New York Transit Queen, really, where it sounds almost like, similar to the way ESG, like, kind of, like, it was like they weren't rapping, but they were, like, aggressively talking on the track, but also rhythmically. It was,
that's,
like,
that's very cool.
Super cool.
It's a really cool reference, because I did find an ESG record amongst Frankie Knuckles stuff as well, you know, Frankie Knuckles archive.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, this band are so cool. I don't know enough about them, you know? I don't know enough about them. But yeah, I really want to use my voice in all these different ways on the record. I mean, I think it was a side project, so I didn't feel any sort of beholding to the music that I've done before. And I thought, it doesn't matter if it's really different to what I've done. in fact, it should be really different to what I've done because it's a side project. It's not me. It's like, you know, I was calling it for, it was like the Chicago project. It was for ages. It was just that. And first it was going to be an EP and then it turned into more. But it, yeah, it was only really towards the end of it that I thought, oh, I really should claim this as my own. It has been my obsession for the last 7 years and I want it to be my record now. But it's only really when I saw my name on it, you know, we worked with this brilliant graph artist called Manu Shribley, who's an art designer, and I'd seen his writing on a skateboard magazine and then just kept calling him like, please, please, can you do this? It just has to be you. And but I realised I hadn't told him, don't put my name on. So I told him, you know, here's some photos and it's called Black Rainbows. But I hadn't quite explained, oh, it's not really my project, it's a side project. So when I saw my name written down, I was like, oh, I forgot to tell him not to put it on. But then when I saw it and the way, just even the way he'd written it made me reimagine myself. It was really weird. But just something about the way he's done that script, just being free from all the different fonts that I feel like I've tried as sort of logos of my own name, and then suddenly there was just this free writing, and I thought, yeah, I like how that looks, I like how that is.
Do you typically look through skate magazines, or is that a
no? It was just a fluke. It was a real fluke. It was just the way they had it presented. I think I've probably got it here, the one I saw.
Oh, cool.
So it's
wow.
Like, who's this elegant sort of black teenager on the front, and then this writing? I mean, so I couldn't even work out what it was called at the time.
Yeah,
so
I was gonna say, what is that called?
I think that's this Renaissance issue, but the magazine's called Numbered. But I really, really like magazine shopping, and there's a shop called Colours May Vary in Leeds that I go to, but there's also this store that's it has like a Carhartt downstairs and loads of skating, but it's got magazines upstairs, and it's everything from punk zines, you know, like rad, you know, trans, bi, queer publications, and then just art house stuff and fashion stuff. And so I always think magazines are really special. I mean, I know you can get loads online now, but just seeing how someone's put all the work into it and putting it together, and, you know, it costs money to make all these shoots. So I was thinking, like, you can pay your £7 or £12 or whatever it is. And I don't know, I'm still really analog, so I love coming home from town with just like 10 magazines. And then you get to see, like, oh, who was the art director? Who was the, you know, so I really like to do that. And I like to read in the bath, you know, so it's just, you can't really do that with your phone. Just, you end up destroying your phone. I've done it before.
I have. Yeah, I do.
Why did I do that?
It's less so fun. Yeah, it's way less fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like at some point people will realize, just like with vinyl, you know, it's that it's like, it's much more fun. You could scroll Instagram or TikTok or Twitter or whatever, but it's way less fun.
It's way less fun. But also there's a limit to it, which is good, where, you know, you never get to the back page of the internet. And so your brain is, I've got this completist thing sometimes when I'm on Instagram, and then I look up and hours have gone past and I think, I'm trying to just get to the end and there will be no end. Whereas with a magazine, you know when you've done the whole thing, you know.
You know, yeah. It's nice. It's like kind of like a sad thing because you got to wait for the next issue. But it's like, it's healthy. It's healthy.
It's,
you know,
like,
you gotta
go and eat some food or like go outside for a walk. You know, it's like that dead-eyed scrolling thing that you can get to it like just before you go to bed. It's so bad. I really try not to do it now.
We're going to pause for a quick break and then come back with more of my conversation with Corinne Bailey Ray. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with Corinne Bailey Ray.
So you weren't thinking of it as a side project, just as a way to trick yourself into being a bit more outside of your comfort zone in music making. You were legitimately thinking about this as something that would not have your name on it.
It wouldn't have my name on it. And then I thought, oh, I'd like, you know, people could be pleasantly surprised if they found out that it was me. But I was really, I think, because as soon as I thought of it as a side project, then I just felt completely free. I'm not doing it for a label. It doesn't have to have radio songs. It doesn't have to have 3-minute songs. They don't have to be catchy. They don't have to have a traditional form. You know, like some of them don't have a second verse, or some of them have no choruses, or some of them have, I don't know, 8 verses or whatever it is. I just wanted to make, and I wanted it to be kind of messy. And I felt all the time really excited that, you know, I think before I would have had a song like Before the Throne of the Invisible God, and then thought, oh, okay, what else can it do? Maybe I should put in a middle 8, or maybe now I've got to get it smaller, now I've got to get it shorter. Could we change the beat? Did it, you know, and I just...
Where does that come from in you?
I think it's just for years of being a label, you know, where you're interacting with people. I mean, when I did my first album, it wasn't without any A&R at all, because we had this really good DJ called Gary Davis who would sort of... I was working in a production company with him. But pretty much we did it amongst ourselves. It was me and Steve Chrysanthou underneath this art shop in a place out of town near Leeds in Yorkshire. And then we could take it to the labels and say, here we are. It's whatever it was, 12 songs. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Some of them loved it. Some of them didn't get it. And then we interviewed, and then we found our home at EMI at that time.
Well, then it sounds like it was sort of you more than the label, right? Because it's like, I mean, the first album is very tight, sort of pop, not in the vacuous sense, but it's very tight songwriting, you
it
know?
Is, and
the
it's, traditional... It is. It's a more sort of pop record, and I think, but yeah, definitely Gary was an influence on that. It was more like I wrote tons of songs, and they were the songs that people were saying, oh, it should be this one, it should be that one. You know, I had a manager at the time, I was young. It's like, oh, yeah, this one, not that one, this one, not that one. I'd already written Like a Star when I was in my band. And, of course, I did want to connect with people. You know, I wanted to make it work. I wanted people to hear it, you know.
Wanted it to be received in a way that was, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted it to be received. It's like I was, you know, I had my English literature degree, but I was working in a cafe and working in a jewellery counter, and you know, going down to London when I could to write these songs with people. And I really wanted to sort of make it, you know, I wanted music to be the thing that I did. So I did work, I worked really hard on that record, and it went through a lot of people's hands in terms of maybe my manager saying yes or no, or Gary Davis saying yes or no, and then obviously various labels eventually saying yes. But I think from then on, because it was so popular, I then felt a real pressure with, you know, certainly my third album, to try and somehow recreate what I had already done. But I knew I didn't want to, because it didn't feel creatively good to do. So I'd had so many meetings where I'd be really excited about a song, you know, we'd work on it and then we'd send it down to whoever was the A&R or the label at the time. We'd be just like, oh, I'm waiting to hear back. I wonder what they think. And then you'd get a sort of response and it'd be like, yeah, it's good. It doesn't sound like the first single. There was always this thing about what's the first single? You know, the first single has to smash the doors down. The first single has to be so catchy. The first single has to be radio friendly. The first single has to be this. It's unique. It's different. It's you. You know, people are basically saying, oh, it needs to be what Put Your Records On did. But of course, that was such a different moment, and it was kind of felt like an accident to me. It was just like, this is a weird song, a little song that I love, and it wasn't like anything else. It was just accidental that it was successful. So then I always, you know, I'd always feel that pressure, and I'd put what I thought was a good offering forward, and the response was always like, not quite like, are you crazy? This isn't it, but not that far off it, you know, just kind of like,
yeah.
Bit of sideways look. And then it'd be, you know, I wrote Like a Star on My Own when I was, you know, a teenager, but there would be a sort of like, oh, maybe we could pair you with this person or that person. So we ended up doing lots of co-writing, which is always weird, where it's like, hi, we don't know each other, we've got 5 hours, let's make a smash hit. But the person would always be like a giant in music, you know, so then it's even more intimidating. Yeah. You're like, if this isn't working out, it's me, not them. And so I just think it sort of crushed my confidence a lot, and it kind of dinted my radar or my instinct for what was right for me, I guess, you know, so I just keep trying.
Starting with the second record?
I mean, the second record was different because it was kind of a reaction to my first album. So I wanted to play more guitars and have it more indie, because my first record was so much more of a pop soul record.
It felt like an evolution. It felt related to your first record, but it felt like a step forward.
Yeah, thanks. And I loved it. I guess I had got more into jazz and into soul, but I also had all my indie stuff. But I think in terms of politically at the label, I had gone through a big loss at that time. You know, my first husband had died really unexpectedly. And so everyone at the label was very kind and understanding, and no one pushed me at that time. So I felt like the first record I got to do what I want. The second record I'd kind of got to do what I want, because nobody wanted to upset me, or they just were happy that I was making something. And genuinely, they were good people. You know, they cared a lot for me. My one A&R person, who I still really love, he's a friend. He came up to see me like every 2 weeks with fancy cakes from London, and we just sat and talked about nothing. And it was a really beautiful time, actually. And then he'd occasionally play me like, hey, there's this bonkers Lady Gaga and Beyonce song, or have you seen this? Or like, he would kind of tell me what's happening in the world, because I was very much in my own sort of bubble. So in a way, I think by the third record, there was a lot of pressure, because maybe they had wanted to do more with the second record, but they couldn't, because I was in this delicate place. So the third record was like, right, we've really got to make this count, you know. And that was the rhetoric around me. It's like, yeah, this is the one, you know, just don't throw it away. That kind of feeling of like, you know.
Got it, yeah.
And because of that, I just felt this immense pressure. I feel like I wrote 3 albums where I could have written one for that. And it was just, what about this? No. What about this? Not the first single. What about this? Don't really hear it. I don't really get that one. And then after a while, I didn't need to go to present it to them. I could just hear the voice in my head saying, don't bother finishing that. It's not an international mega smash, you know. And it's really rough. I sort of look back on that time and feel really sorry for the me that was that person. And I look at The Heart Speaks and Whispers and think, well, I'm really glad. I'm glad that I got as much done as I did. And I'm glad that there are some good songs on that record. But it was really hard to work from an instinctive place, even though the record was about following your instincts. You know, it's called The Heart Speaks and Whispers. But those whispers were very easily sort of drowned out by other people and by myself, probably. You know, so with this record, I knew I wasn't at a label. I didn't think it would take as long as it did, but I was like, I am just going to do something completely different to anything I've done before. Like, I'm not going to feel those pressures. I'm not going to think about radio. I'm not going to think about what I've done before because it's not even my name. And because of that, there was just this torrent of creativity. And not just that, because I was working within this archive, the labour was like sitting reading a bunch of Ebony magazines, you know, or like going to an amazing exhibition in New York, Soul of a Nation, or going flying to Milan to see Betty Saar's retrospective, you know, at the Prada Foundation.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it as work and it wasn't work. That was me just sort of following my muse. But all of those rich things that you're all fed into the record. So it was really fun to do. And the right way to do stuff, I guess, is just to wait until you're really excited and then just let it fly out.
How did you end up in Chicago, that first trip where you visited?
I was on tour. I was on tour with The Heart Speaks in Whispers. So we had done, you know, we had probably done New York and done, you know, Connecticut or somewhere. And then we'd flown into Chicago. And I remember saying to one of my managers, oh, I'm really annoyed because I really wanted to meet this brilliant artist, Theaster Gates. And I didn't tell you. And now he won't be able to come to the show. Like, I was really fatalistic. And she somehow managed to find him that day. And he did come to the show. I didn't know. And when I was getting changed, she shouted at me, she's like, don't get changed, come out, with someone to meet you. And I was so excited to see him. I didn't know he was going to be there. I'd seen photos of him, so I knew it was him. And I was just buzzing to talk to him and be like, you know, you've saved this building from demolition. That's what you do. That's part of your art practice. And you're into ceramics. And I love ceramics. And, you know, he has this background in the Black Church, and he has this band called the Black Monks of Mississippi, and so he's got this music part of what he does as well, and he lectures at the university, and he's super brainy, and so I just was like, you know, really excited to meet another creative person, and because it's art, you know, there's no rivalry. I mean, there'd be no rivalry between the two of us. Theaster is a literally internationally known, you know, artist whose works sell for, you know, millions. And but it was really good to just have a seam that, you know, he had nothing really to do with the music industry, and I, of course, had nothing to do with the art world. And so it was just kind of meeting, getting to know each other as friends.
That's so cool. That's like it all came together and that it inspired this sort of next, like a rediscovery of yourself, too. While we're talking about the first record, I really like the first record. I think it's really good. Yes. But it always seemed like, I remember reading interviews from you at the time, that it seemed like your influences were a bit deeper than that record conveyed, you know, or more varied than that record conveyed. Not, and it's a really great album. Yeah. I mean, it's like a really well done album, but it always did strike me that it's like, oh, there's something else going on though. And there's some undercurrents that aren't being expressed, you know?
I'm really glad you could see that and feel that. And that's how I felt at the time. It was a funny mixture of feeling. I feel really accepted because people have taken this thing that I made in my hometown. I played on my guitar and I wrote, and then here it is in the world. But also, it felt like I was somehow keeping a part of myself secret or hiding a part of myself. And maybe that is that part, you know, it's like the music that didn't necessarily come straight out of Black cultures, or the music that I'd grown up listening to, you know, like the indie music. I mean, I know rock has a Black origin as well, but I didn't get to show the part of me that loves electric guitar and loves indie music and this complex simplicity of a band like Nirvana, you know, the simple, direct nature of that kind of music. And or like weird, you know, Bjork or Tori Amos or, you know, those. I felt like on the first record, I didn't get to show the whole thing. I just felt like I've got more and different things to say. And I, you know, I just want to keep feeling that there's more to say. More to say, or else why would you sort of, you know, why would you bother saying it?
Yeah. One thing that was cool about the first record that stood out, because it didn't feel like that was a time when it was like there was a lot of kind of milquetoast acoustic music, I don't want to name anyone, but your music felt particularly a little deeper. And I think it, because it connected to, like, I was thinking about it, like, in the States, I guess we have Bill Withers, but beyond Bill Withers, there wasn't a strong tradition of, like, the soulful singer-songwriter, even mm-hmm. though there was great songwriters in soul music. Whereas in the UK, Linda Lewis or Labby Siffery, like there's these people who could like play guitar acoustically and make records that were essentially soul records. And it mm-hmm. kind of felt like that was similar to what you were doing. And that kind of resonated with me, at least, you know, there's like this really great songwriting that it's soulful, but it's just presented in this way that is unique, at least I think feel like in the States, you know. So as soon as someone pulls out an acoustic guitar out here, it gets immediately, it's a little saccharine, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you said that. And I mean, Bill Withers is, I mean, obviously a god in everyone's world, but he is, you know, right at the top of the tree. And I watched that documentary, I don't know if you saw it a few years ago, it came out, Still Bill, you know,
that's one of my favorites.
That's such a good album. But you know, the documentary that came out when he was still alive, and he was talking about this period of his life where people were saying, kind of trying to convince him to change his style. You know, he said there was people at the record label and he called them the Black Spurts. And he'd say, like, you know, he's like, you need to get up off that stool and you need to get two dancers and the gold lamé shirt and just start, you know, maybe disco was coming in and his kind of homely, folksy, you know,
West style. Virginia.
Yeah, it was somehow not seen as commercial enough, but also there was an undertone to like, oh, it's not black enough.
It's not black enough.
Yeah, it's not black enough.
That's always what struck me about being black in the UK from afar. I've only been to London once, but from afar, it always seemed as if y'all had a little more freedom over there to express layers of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, whereas what's black is very, you know, put on the whatever, the lamé shirt and you know, go dance disco. It's like, what?
It's so interesting with African-American culture, because obviously black American music is kind of like the pinnacle to me of like creative arts. Partly it comes out of that segregation and separatism. So I know what you mean. Yeah. It's like, it's a very specific blackness that which is very specifically not whiteness.
Yeah.
And in the UK, it's more messy and hybrid because we didn't have legalized segregation. You know, you had the black African people working plantations, but they were in the Caribbean and that was separate from England, even though they were owned by English white people, Scottish
separate,
and English.
Whole separate culture.
Yeah. But then when the Caribbeans came, they, I guess, had already been in a hybrid culture where they were black majority islands, but there were lots of white people there and, you know, they're influencing each other and then sort of coming in, but also being influenced by American imports, you know, vinyl imports. And, you know, think of like a Bob Marley and how much he's obviously into Curtis Mayfield and all those harmonies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he's also doing his own thing with it. So I always think like Caribbean music is sort of hybridized anyway. And then you get this thing in blackness where the people are black, like my dad's family came from the Caribbean, but they also thought of themselves as British because the Caribbeans were a British colony. So they already had their British passport. So it's a really different scene, black Britishness. But I know what you mean. I think it's less defined. It's less strengthened by institutions and the black universities and the NAACP and the black church, and they're all the things that make black American music so great. But I also think the sort of the hybrid messy thing of the UK means that I feel like people feel blackness is less defined. It's not like someone's drawn a chalk circle around you, and if you step out of it, you're not authentic or, you know, your blackness is in question. And then, of course, mine's further complicated because my mum is white, my dad's black. So it's like,
yeah,
it's that as well. So I always used to, you know, be playing and think, is this, do I like this because I am not black? Do I like this because I'm, or, and then I would find loads of my black friends would also be feeling or being accused of not being black enough, you know? So you realize that it's a construct. And then, you know, even to this day, my you know, black girlfriends will be like, I'm going to the carnival, West Indian carnival. So like, I need these kind of earrings and this kind of clothes to almost present as blackness. Yeah. So it's, that thing has really done a number on all of us where we limit ourselves or because we think that there's a certain expectation of blackness. And that was another reason why the record's called Black Rainbows, because I really wanted to push out to say, like, oh yeah, this is a punk track, but, you know, I'm wearing a Bad Brains t-shirt in the video because Bad Brains is this amazing black punk band, and, you know, this dissenting music also has a black thread and black origins, and they've been kind of written out, not Bad Brains specifically, but those black and ska kind of origins of punk are sometimes not acknowledged. Yeah. You know,
recently a Bob Seger song came on the radio for me, and I was like, oh fuck, I was like, no one, I just never listened to Bob Seger. Yeah. Like something from one of his first records came on, I was like, damn, why did no one tell me how great this is? So I started listening, and I kind of got a little obsessed with like hard rock music, or like the origins of hard rock, like, you know, late 60s through the 70s. And so I started making like a playlist, like kind of like what was the stuff that made hard rock. And what I realized was listening is a lot of it came from, well, there's a lot that came from London. There's a lot that came from Detroit.
Yeah.
And a lot that came from LA, but a lot of it was out of Detroit, and a lot of it was white guys trying to be soulful, trying to do R&B.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you could say that's the start of the Beatles, right?
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And there was a big scene in the UK, a kind of Northern Soul scene, which was definitely, you know, young white bands hearing American imports and wanting to, you know, do them. Or you think of, you know, sort of Patti Smith, you know, singing, quoting a Motown song, or, you know, Tainted Love, you know, being redone by Mark Almond. There was many incidents. And as we were saying earlier, you know, the Beatles themselves picking all these like Little Richard songs to cover. And it's like
Stones.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah. And they all really acknowledge, you know, oh, we love Muddy Waters. But, you know, at the time, the irony of it was that it kind of took white English young kids appreciating black R&B to kind of sell it black white America. You know, they took it as like, it's the British invasion. It's as like, you guys should just change the radio channel occasionally. Twist and shout, you know. It's like, listen to the Isley Brothers, or listen to Chuck Berry, or listen to, you know, but for some reason it filtered through that, connected with them for all the different complicated reasons
that had to be that way.
But I mean, that relationship between the bouncing back and forth between sort of the UK and the US is something that I'm really, you know, into, and following those threads, you know, I love the music history.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. I mean, into your point about like those blues and soul imports that like kind of would find a home in the UK, that there was really not much of a home for them in the US. That's another thing about the UK that I've always envied from afar, is it's like, it's always been a place for black people to go to feel, except, you know, the classic stories like Hendrix going there, or just other various places in Europe where, you know, jazz musicians are just going, because it's like, or Tina Turner just moving to Sweden because it's like, this is way better, you know?
Yeah.
Or Switzerland or Sweden, one of those.
Yeah, just people escaping the particular type of American racism, which one that comes out of that long-standing segregation and just the amount of brainwashing around, you know, we are different, inherently different peoples, you know, all of that racial constructs that's so powerful in America. I think it is nice for black people to come to Europe. I'm not saying it's not a land without racism, but it's different flavour. And but even just the difference really makes you realise how subjective and constructed the whole thing is.
Yeah.
We're going to take one last quick break and then come back with more from my conversation with Corinne Bailey Ray. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with the rest of my conversation with Corinne Bailey Ray.
Let's talk about Peach Velvet Sky.
Yeah.
You used to work in a jazz club, correct?
Yes, I used to work in a jazz club. So when I was at university, I worked in this jazz and soul club called The Underground. And first I was collecting the coats to hang up. And then I was working behind the bar, which was the really good job because the bar was opposite the stage. So as you were working, you could just be watching all these incredible jazz musicians come through and brilliant bands. You know, I remember Roy Ayers playing there one time, or like, oh, wow, Cast Latina All-Stars, you know, like lots of, like they would always get Cuban musicians and Terry Callier, you know, you could just kind of watch and learn, as well as lots of, you know,
shit,
people from,
wow,
the UK.
There's another one. There's another beautiful,
yes,
soulful,
yeah,
singer-songwriter just like out of control, you know?
Yeah, Terry Callier. Yeah, yeah, so beautiful. And that sensitivity, I think of John Lucien as well, you know. But Peach Velvet Sky I had written because I saw lots of copies of this one book in the Arts Bank, and it was a book that I had read as a teenager. It's a book that had been sent to me by my American aunts. My dad's got four sisters. Everybody came here from St. Kitts, and then two of them moved to New Jersey when they were in their early 20s. And so they were my American aunts, and they would send me, you know, books or stuff, clothes, Kool-Aid sometimes, or like barrettes for my hair. But they, my Aunt Joyce sent me this book, and it was called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. It's part of a six narratives, early African-American narratives. And I read it, and I was just so struck by this woman's story, that she had grown up on this plantation in 1813. You know, she grew up under the authority of her parents, and then as she got a little bit older, she realised she was in this institution, you know, from which there was no escape. There was an authority above her parents that she couldn't, you know, violate at all. And then later on in her life, the ownership of her changed, so that she had this master, this new master, who was also the local doctor, but he developed this obsession with her. And he believed himself to be in love with her. So he would be always trying to sort of pursue her and, you know, sort of sexually aggress her. And Harriet Jacobs ended up having two children in her teens with a local man, a white man who her grandmother had put her in touch with to see if he could help her. And he obviously, however, I don't know the exact situation of their relationship and even how she writes it. It seems as though this is a, you know, a love relationship. But they have two children together. And this incenses this doctor even more, you know, this master. And he's violent. At one point, he's very violent with one of the children. He throws the boy against the wall and he's in a coma for days. And she realises she has to get away and she realises she has to get her children away. So she makes it seem as though she's fled to the north. But in fact, she's hiding out in the crawl space above her free grandmother's storehouse on the plantation. You know, it's not big enough to stand up in, but she can crawl and, you know, her grandmother can let her out to the storehouse to move around. She's feeding her. And she waits until the coast is clear and she waits until he's expended a lot of effort and money and time looking for her in the north. So she stays in this crawl space for 7 years. And while she's there, she bores this hole in the side of the building. It's a wooden building, like this tiny hole, so that people can't see in, but she can see out, so she can look out and see her children playing, because her grandmother brings her children nearby, or she can hear, you know, passing comments, you know, things that might be pertaining to her freedom. You know, she's got enough light to sew by. And I just, when I saw it in the Arts Bank, I reread it because I thought, what's this like now to read as an adult, to read as a woman, to read as a mother? And it was just... Yeah. You know, it's so much of a story of waiting and patience and resilience, and just think of someone's mental fortitude to be able to make a prison for yourself, in effect, so that when you do eventually escape, you're safe. And you can, you know, she does send for her children, and she ends up setting up a school with her daughter for children leaving slavery in 1865. But I was really drawn to this story. And one time I was trying to get to sleep and I thought about this loophole that Harriet Jacobs had, you know, what the sky looked like from her loophole, you know, what the sunset looked like, and how wide and vast it seemed when she eventually found her freedom.
Wow, that's beautiful. And the chords on the song are beautiful. I don't know how it developed into like that sort of... what kind of rapturous, gorgeous song that it became. But it's like all the elements of that are just beautiful. And that it's sort of, in terms of production value, the least sort of adventurous, but it's like all the, musically, it's all there, but it fits in between these two songs that are just sort of, you're like, how does it fit? That's the whole kind of thing about this record to me. It's like, how the fuck does this song fit to this song? But it's beautiful. It's all gorgeous.
I wanted
gorgeous.
To make the track order like a sort of, one thing would be a palate cleanse for the other. So just when it was sort of, too, you know, overwhelming, then I would want to do something beautiful, and then, but then I want to do something, you know, I just wanted to keep, I don't know, just keep changing the mood, I guess. But yeah, with Peach Velvet Sky, I wrote that on guitar, but it was much more of a simple, you know, folk song. And then when I worked with Steve Brown, who I've worked with for a long time, him also married to, he has a really, really good ear, and he's a jazz musician, so I guess the song kind of developed this extra richness and the much more complex harmony because of what he was sort of putting in. And so we would just rehearse it together, and I'd say, come on, we need to record it, and he'd say, it's not, you know, we haven't got it yet, we don't want to record it until it's like we're doing it on stage. And that's how we ended up doing it. So it felt risky to me because I normally like to sort of track things as you go along and then almost say, well, this, you know, it worked and it's down now. But we were just putting lots of rehearsals with that. And
I'm glad you did, because your vocal performance on that is phenomenal. It's like really crazy. It's like, goddamn, you know, that's a tough vocal performance.
And thank
you.
Like
you really nail it. You know?
I really feel with these stories, they're so much bigger than my own personal story. You know, when you think of Harriet Jacobs and surviving this sexual aggression, and then, you know, her parents die and she's a slave girl. And then she's a teenage parent to this man who he says he's going to free her children, but he hasn't done it yet. And he goes on to be this prominent politician. And then she's constantly got this man, and then how to escape it and thinking of doing it. And then that's 7 years. This guy can't get round that sort of, you know, she could just scream out in the middle of the night and it would completely blow a cover. It's like, how does she hold on and hold back and kind of slow herself down for that amount of time, but then get into this very active, you know, getting on a boat, going north, I just think of what's kind of gone on in her mind. You know, she's so to me the thing of mental health was I was really sort of thinking of in the song. And, you know, are there any points where she does become sort of maddened and is slightly cracked by just the, you know, eventually while she's in there, they try and get her home by putting her children in prison. You know, they say, your mother's so unfeeling. How can she not come from the north when she knows you're in prison? And she just is holding this line. It's this huge gamble that she takes. And I'm really fascinated by her. She lived into her 80s, Harriet Jacobs, but...
You mentioned earlier there's sort of other songs that you've written for this project that you plan to put out in some way, shape, or form. How far along with that are you?
I think at one point I was working at 20 songs all at the same time, and I thought, this is just crazy because none of them are going to get finished because I know what I'm like and I always just take too long. So then I just thought, right, just focus on these 10 because they're close to being finished and leave the other 10 for now. So... yeah, I guess I'll go back to them and revisit them. But they all came around about at the same time as the rest of the song. So
it'd be beautiful to hear another project related to it.
Wow.
And it's great to hear you talk about this stuff. You know, it's like it's refreshing to hear someone who's connected to the world through art in the way that you are on this record.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it has really been an obsession. And I say that, you know, there's so much in there. There's so much in that bank. You know, those 26,000 books and all those stories and all those, you could just look at a newspaper article or someone staring out of a photo or find, you know, a little stitch handmade black doll. And just, you know, it's like they're all objects that have come to us through history for, you know, how do they get here? And, you know, what have they observed? And I just find the whole thing really fascinating. And, you know, there are obviously so many of the questions that the objects are asking are still questions and still, you know, hotly debated things now. I think the fact that the history wasn't done was the thing that made me interested in it as well, you know.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much for putting the record out. Thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much. It's been really great to talk to you.
Thanks to Corinne Bailey Rae for explaining the inspiration for her newest album, Black Rainbows. You can hear it along with our favorite songs from her on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced and edited by Leah Rose with marketing help from Eric Sandler and Jordan McMillan. Our engineer is Ben Tolliday. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, musora.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.